Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's Dot Foil Computer Services, and we are at facebook.com/radiocafe. We've got a packed show for you today. We're going to be hearing about world peace, a teen comedy show, and economic development in Santa Fe with Mayor David Koss. I'd like to welcome now Bart Paul. He is the author of the new book, Double-Edged Sword, The Many Lives of Hemingway's Friend, the American Matador, Sidney Franklin. And he will be speaking this coming Saturday, December 12th, at 4:30 in the afternoon at Garcia Street Books here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you. Nice to be here.
So this is a very interesting character whom I had never heard of. He was the son of Russian Jewish immigrants born and raised in Brooklyn, and he became a bullfighter, which was, in those days, a very rare, if not unique, thing for an American to be. Tell us his early life story.
Well, he was one of nine children born to, as you said, immigrants from Tsarist Russia. His dad was a cop with the NYPD, worked out of Brooklyn's 78th Precinct. And he was born in 1903, and a pretty typical New York melting pot sort of life. But he was, unlike his four brothers and his four sisters, he was a little frail. He didn't participate in sports much, had an artistic bent, and was, by the time he finally left home, he dropped out of school and formed his own silkscreen business. He was apparently a fairly talented artist. And then conflict with his father sent him, cashed out his bank account and took a boat out of New York and ended up in Veracruz. And then when he settled in Mexico City, he started yet another silkscreen business. But he had no knowledge of bullfighting, no interest in it, and barely spoke Spanish when he got off the boat.
And it's so amazing, I think, so many people's biographies, they start with somebody being weak or frail in certain ways, and then that person overcomes it to become just extraordinarily strong in ways that you never would have expected from their childhood. How did he get interested? I mean, he had a successful career and a very nice life. How did he get interested in bullfighting?
He shot his mouth off, basically. Sidney was always a bit full of himself, and there were really no half measures with this guy, and he had a very large sense of self, and he was he'd fallen in with a fairly artistic, theatrical crowd in Mexico City, which in 1922 was a fairly cosmopolitan place, even though the revolution had just barely finished. And one night after dinner, there was the subject of courage came up, and his friends were saying that only a Latin had the courage to actually be a bullfighter, and Sidney basically felt that Americans shouldn't take a backseat to anyone, and he quite loudly contradicted them, and they told him to put up or shut up, and said, if that's the case, well, step in a bull ring yourself and see what it's like. So he somehow wangled tutoring instruction from the most famous Mexican matador of the era, a rather legendary guy named Rodolfo Gaona, and he studied with Gaona and Gaona's other students outside of Mexico City on a daily basis for several weeks, and then he went to a bull breeding ranch north of Mexico City for another couple of weeks, and was sort of bullied into a semi-professional engagement with the suit of lights and everything else, where he actually had to kill the bull, which he, of course, did not plan on and had not been tutored in. And he was lucky he didn't get killed himself, but he loved the adulation. He loved the crowd, the worshipful crowd and everything else. And frankly, he liked how he looked. The first time he put on a suit of light, he just looked in the mirror, and I think it was love at first sight. His quote was, "I look like a Christmas tree."
Just so that people know what you mean by a suit of lights, I mean, I guess when you think about the traditional bullfighter with this very heavy and elaborate costume, tell us a little bit about that outfit.
Well, never having worn one myself, it's from what we've all seen in movies and photographs and things, it goes back to the 18th century. It's very tight. It's covered with brocade and heavy, you know, gold stitching and the like. And it's a tight jacket, tight trousers to just below the knee, little slippers, a little hat that's, they call a montera. Again, it goes back to the 18th century, and it's very colorful, and Sydney had them designed in many different colors and styles and things. But it's also quite heavy to weigh 20 pounds. And when you get into it, apparently, you're almost immobile. Sydney's analogy was it's like sticking your hand into a glove that's too tight, and eventually it sort of loosens up to where you can move around.
Which is amazing for somebody who has to be incredibly agile in the ring. So how did he actually break into the career of bullfighting first in Mexico?
Well, it was really unheard of for an American. He wasn't the first to try it, but he had to overcome quite a bit. This is nothing you can just, you know, practice on weekends. He had to shut down his silkscreen business, hawk most of his belongings, and just like any other young Spaniard or Mexican, he had to just immerse himself in the life 24 hours a day. And because it's all practice by rote and learning the moves and rehearsing them over and over, and with the heavy cape and then the smaller cape and the sword and all the various stages of a bullfight. So when you actually get in the ring and this monster is thundering down on you, you just have to rely on almost muscle memory to go out there and do it. It was difficult at first for him. He got a few exhibition fights because there was a novelty value in this red-headed, freckle-faced, you know, North American who was down there in this very Latin pastime. And he eventually started making a little money and became essentially a semi-pro, what they call a noviero. It's like a minor league ball player, I guess is the best analogy. And he spent most of the 1920s, from 1923 to the end of 1928, just barnstorming around Mexico, getting fights where he could, learning his trade, and really falling in love with the whole role of a bullfighter. That was a role that he just that defined him long after he was active.
So then at a certain point, it became clear that if he was really going to make it, he had to go to Spain. Spain was the epicenter of bullfighting, and I suppose probably still is.
Indeed. He, to become a full matador, what they call a matador de toros, there's a couple of things that I guess are part of the process. The first is a ceremony called the Alternativa, where it's basically the bullfight establishment says that you are ready to then alternate with the pros, and you graduate from basically the minors to the majors. It's like getting your diploma or being called up by the Yankees. But at the time, in the spring of 1929, early summer, when he went to Spain, no American had ever set foot in a Spanish bull ring. Now, there had been an American matador around 1910 named Harper B. Lee, who was born in the States and raised in Guadalajara, and he had taken his Alternativa in Monterrey, Mexico. But what is customary is then the bullfighter, no matter where he's from, Spain, Mexico, Peru, then has to repeat that ceremony, at least this is my understanding, in Madrid. Actually, they call it confirming one Alternativa. But, of course, you have to take it first. So Sydney had a fairly insurmountable task ahead of him, because if it was difficult in Mexico, it was essentially impossible in Spain. The Spanish promoters were not really interested in him. They considered him to be sort of a Yankee Mexican and were not prone to give him any fights at all. But he had, in the back of his mind, he knew that there was an American exposition in Sevilla, and he was counting on his novelty value there. So it was actually the American community in Spain that raised money for him and basically covered the promoter's expenses. And in July, I believe it was, of 1929, he set foot in a Spanish bull ring, and it's customary for the matador to fight two bulls in an afternoon. And he killed them both, and the press at the time said he was brilliant. They said, "We came, you know, expecting to see a gringo, but what we saw was a torero." That began about 8 or 9 months of him just being absolutely on top of the world.
We're talking to Bart Paul, author of Double-Edged Sword, The Many Lives of Hemingway's Friend, the American Matador, Sidney Franklin. So Sidney Franklin was successful in Spain, and he continued for a while to be a successful American bullfighter in Spain until he had a horrible incident in the bull ring.
That's correct. He began his debut in Sevilla was about halfway through the 1929 season, which starts around March and ends in October. And he was really at the top of his game. He was still a noviero. He was still essentially a minor leaguer, as it were. But because of the novelty factor and because he was considered to be pretty good, he really held the promoters up for top dollar. And within about 6 weeks of his initial debut, he had performed again by then in Sevilla. He'd performed in Madrid. And he was traveling around the countryside with an entourage because bullfighters need a staff to go with them of picadors and all sorts of other ring servants and things. And about 6 weeks into that, he met Ernest Hemingway. And this would have been in the end of August in 1929 or perhaps early September. Their accounts are contradictory. And Hemingway was researching Death in the Afternoon and his first nonfiction book about bullfighting. And he wanted to travel with Sidney to get a real up-close look instead of just watching the thing from the stands. I guess another analogy would be it'd be like sitting in the dugout with a team and traveling with them. So the two of them traveled together for, well, Sidney claims it was a couple of months. In reality, it was probably closer to maybe 10 days. And by the 1950s, Hemingway said it didn't happen at all. But they became very good friends because they were both young men in different occupations on their way up. Hemingway had had The Sun Also Rises published, which not only put him on the map, but put Spanish bullfighting on the map for Americans. But it was before he became legendary and iconic. It was about a month before A Farewell to Arms was published. So Sidney continued, finished out that season, and he and Hemingway decided together that Sidney should work on his technique, especially the sword play at the end, the killing act. And before he took the Alternativa, he was going to put it off till the 1930 season. So Hemingway and his wife went back to Key West, and Sidney stayed on and prepared for the following season. And it was the second bullfight of the 1930 season in March in Madrid when he was almost killed. He was gored by a bull that he had killed, and it just in its last moment of life, it hooked him. And penetrated his abdominal cavity at the base of his spine through the rectum. And again, he's lucky he didn't die right then, and lucky that subsequently he didn't die of peritonitis, because this was, of course, before penicillin.
So he amazingly got himself together, and 5 weeks later, it's almost impossible to believe, he was back in the bull ring.
Yeah, I think he instinctively knew that he couldn't... He couldn't back off from this. And, of course, that the high point in his career was passed. When he was gored, that was pretty much it. He fought a few more times, but he wasn't physically quite up to it. As you said, it was amazing that he came back after just 5 weeks, but that the interior wounds were still knitting, and sometimes the adhesions inside his body would almost have to be torn and broken open for him to just function in the bull ring. There were some times when he said he could barely walk. So he did literally limp through the end of that season, and then he went to Mexico for the winter season and was gored again in 1931. He was gored in the leg. And it was very difficult for him. He had a bad reaction to an anti-tetanus drug, and he tried to get fights, but... Hemingway points this out at the end of Death in the Afternoon in a chapter devoted to Sidney. The promoters really took their revenge on him a bit because they felt that he had held him up for high fees when he was at the top of his game. So when he was struggling a bit, they would put him off and he would find bookings difficult. So his career as a Spanish matador ended fairly abruptly after that.
So what happened next? As you write about him in his book, he's somebody who keeps picking himself up and moving on.
Yeah, well, one thing, he doesn't move very far from the idea of being a bullfighter. That role, that identity, became so important to him that he really refused to give it up. And even though he wouldn't fight in Spain again for a long time, he got the occasional fight in Mexico, but money was a problem. There's some telegrams and letters that he sent to Hemingway where he complains about this is now by 1933, 1934, where he wanted to basically get back in the ring in Mexico, have a good season, and then get back to Spain. But then he writes a full year after that saying, you know, money is a problem, his health is a problem, his wound is still draining. He had 9 operations, also. And so he fights very sporadically, and he ends up turning to other things for quite a while, and including he translates a novel. And, of course, he has trouble with it, so he has to go to Hemingway for help on that. He wrote a very nice magazine piece on bullfighting and made a little money doing that. He was starting to work on his autobiography, which didn't come out till 1952, and he was really hoping that Hemingway would help him with that, which didn't ever quite materialize. He was in an Eddie Cantor movie in a cameo, doing a little bullfight sequence in a movie called The Kid from Spain, which is interesting. He doesn't have any lines, but you can rent a DVD and actually see him in action with a cape. But it was very difficult for him. He spent a lot of his time living with his sisters in Brooklyn, and his letters to Hemingway have a sort of a poignant, plaintive air to them. Because Hemingway is, you know, becoming more and more successful. And he's also moved on to other things in his life. He's interested in deep-sea fishing and big game hunting. And after Death in the Afternoon came out, his interest in bullfighting waned considerably for a decade or more. So it was a rough time for Sidney.
Another quality of Sidney's life, which we haven't talked about, is that he was gay, which was certainly not something that you could be out with as a bullfighter or as anybody in his time.
No, and he apparently, in speaking to people who had met him, he didn't come across that way. He had sort of a booming baritone voice. A woman who interviewed him said he sounded like a cop or a fight promoter. And again, he was a very confident, cocky man, had a real Brooklyn air about him, very combative in his speech, and always just a torrent of cliche, that was a part that he kept quiet at least for a while, at least till perhaps the 1950s it became known a little bit. But whether Hemingway knew in the beginning or at what point Hemingway knew is just the subject of conjecture, because there certainly were a couple of gay bullfighters. Hemingway mentions a couple of fellows derisively in the end of Death in the Afternoon, and the glossary for the term for homosexual, maricón. He mentions 2 of them, and I doubt that either one was Sidney, but you don't know. So it was a difficult time. But again, by the late 40s, early 50s, the people in the bullfighting establishment seemed to have a sense that that was the case, that he was homosexual.
So you chose to write a biography of this interesting person, Sidney Franklin, and as you write, that it's tricky with the sources, because he tended to fabricate all sorts of stories about his own life, and getting solid information seems to have been tricky business for you.
Oh, very much so. And by the time he met Hemingway, then there were 2 different versions. By the time he went to cover the Spanish Civil War with Hemingway in 1937, there were certain instances where he had written where Hemingway, Hemingway's third wife, Martha Gellhorn, Hemingway's friend, John Dos Passos, had all written about their life together, their time together, and well, the city was under siege by Franco's forces. And most of the accounts contradict themselves. So you have to sort of wade through all that and figure out, well, what is the probable truth in it? And sometimes it's just unknowable.
What is Sidney Franklin's legacy for readers today?
What I found fascinating about the guy was just this incredible tenacity, just his refusal to give up on himself. Because he was still in a bull ring in 1959 when he was 56 years old. And he was gored, not horribly, but, I think any time an animal that weighs about 1,500 pounds comes thundering at you and, you know, rips into you with a horn, it can't be fun. Wouldn't know myself, but in speaking to people who've had it happen, it's pretty horrific. And he was a true American character. He was probably not the easiest person to know, not the easiest friend to have. And in my research, I worked with a couple of people who knew him. One is the author and aficionado Barnaby Conrad, who met Sidney back when Barney was 21 years old. This would have been during the Second World War in Spain. And then there was a movie director named Bud Bedeker, who had, like Sidney, had studied to be a matador as a young man in Mexico until his mother found out. And then he went on to work for Columbia and Universal and things. And they gave me some insights into Sidney. Conrad knew him quite well, knew him, was a good and devoted friend to him for 30 years. And he says he was a difficult fellow, and he was glad that the book ended up, as Barney said, warts and all.
Bart Paul is the author of the book Double-Edged Sword, The Many Lives of Hemingway's Friend, the American Matador, Sidney Franklin. He died in the 1970s lived to a somewhat ripe old age. And what was he like at the end of his life, do you know?
He'd had a stroke, and he was incapacitated, couldn't speak. So, I mean, the two things that he really relied on, his feet, which bullfighters, of course, need, and his mouth, which he had always used quite effectively. Hemingway once said when he went to Spain and was telling his wife's family that he was taking Sidney with him, he said, because he can talk his way out of anything. So that was difficult for Sidney to be, you know, wheelchair-bound and speechless. But the book ends with a story that Conrad told me when Conrad and one of Sidney's brothers, who was an accountant, his brother Milton, came to visit him. And he was still full of his old mischief, and he was sitting in the wheelchair, and he pointed to a calendar on the wall, which had bullfight scenes of Sevilla. And he pointed to the calendar, and he sort of rolled his hand over, meaning, you know, in the future, next year. And then he pointed to Conrad, he pointed to himself, and then he took a handkerchief. And from his wheelchair, quite silently, he performed a Veronica, the basic pass of a bullfighter, as if to say, you and me next year at the bullfights. So he never really ever gave up on that whole concept of himself. And that, I guess, is what's remarkable about him.
Bart Paul will be speaking about his book on Saturday at Garcia Street Books at 4:30 in the afternoon. We look forward to having you in Santa Fe.
Well, it'll be great to be there. I look forward to it, too, and I hope you can come.
Thank you. We're going to take a break right now. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'm very happy now to welcome George Paz Martin. He is a peace activist. He is the former national co-chair of United for Peace and Justice, and he is a current Green Party leader, a former Black Panther leader, and he will be speaking on Friday night at 7 o'clock at the Unitarian Church here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you, Mary Charlotte.
So you are new in town.
Oh, just here about 6 weeks and glad to be here.
Tell us about some of the work you've done. I mean, you were involved in international peace work as much as anybody around. What's some of the work that's going on that our listeners may not know about?
Well, I'll tell you, I was co-chair of United for Peace and Justice for the last 6 years. And in that role, United for Peace and Justice is our country's largest peace coalition. And so in representing and working internationally, the benefits are tremendous. And I work within the World Social Forum movement and have worked all over the world there, and also within the World Peace Council. And so within the World Social Forum, it gives me the opportunity to work with leaders of peace movements from other countries. And so, for example, in Kenya in 2007, I was chosen as spokesperson for 50 peace movements. And we get together and we support each other. We share our struggles, but we come to solidarity around issues. So annually, as we have worked against the war in Iraq and demonstrate nationally here in the U.S., we will have anywhere from 40 to 60 countries demonstrating on those same weekends and working with their governments. And so that's had an effect in terms of other countries stepping away from the coalition within the U.S. around Iraq and Afghanistan.
Now, that's something that I'm always interested in, is because in this country, protest, getting out on the streets and protesting, doesn't seem to have quite the effect that it used to. Maybe I'm wrong about that, but in other countries, it actually changes the government's behavior.
Yes, and you know, and I think you know the issue comes up where are the people in the streets as they were during the Vietnam War? You know, and during the Vietnam War, it took 8 years to reach a majority sentiment against war. During this Iraq War, we accomplished that in 4 years. And at the
heck, you accomplished it before the war even started. I mean, there was a huge number of people out on the streets.
February 15th, the New York Times deemed us the second greatest power on earth aside from the U.S. government. But at the same time, in comparison, we have a lot stronger foe that's more corporately oriented, controlling media. And so I'm glad to have this interview to get out the truth. But, you know, that's the difference between now and then. And within that struggle, we also, you know, have the situation in terms of the U.S. Congress. And, you know, quite frankly, being a black man, I'm very proud to have a black president. But at the same time, I remind people that if Obama wanted to do all that we in the peace movement wanted, it still couldn't happen, because even within the Progressive Democratic Party, not more than half have ever voted against any war bill or against any war budget. So, you know, the task has been there since then, and it's created a more difficult struggle.
I think when people talk about war and peace, there are two separate conversations that need to be brought together. One is a kind of hard wiring in, especially the male half of the human species, that you have to defend your territory and fight and all that kind of thing. And there's this like biological instinct to fight. Then there's a whole other conversation, which is the amount of money and resources and corporate interest that is put into the war machine,
yeah,
which is kind of a self-sustaining organism all by itself.
And I'd like to go back to 9/11. You know, we all mourn the loss of our fellow Americans, but at the same time, it was a criminal act, and it wasn't an act by a country. And at the same time, we attacked Afghanistan, we attacked and occupied Iraq. And as we look back, the American public has come to realize that that was the wrong thing to do. And so here, as we increase the troops in Afghanistan, it's so difficult. And I had the fortune of going to Iraq on a fact-finding mission.
When were you there?
I was there in January 2004 for 2 weeks and met with Iraqi civil society and also met with our troops. I have served our troops in terms of PTSD and homelessness for 20 years. And so that's very important to me. And at the same time, what we're doing militarily has not been the real accomplishment. You know, the surge in Iraq, the success wasn't around our military efforts. It was more around Muqtada al-Sadr calling time out in some form of truce. And so this notion that a surge in Afghanistan is going to do it is really false. And we need to listen. We need to listen to those people in those occupied countries and the people of Afghanistan and the people of Pakistan across religious lines all say that we need to come home. And that's what we work toward. And we need to stop the money, that goes into this. As we're sitting here in the U.S., closing schools, don't have health care, not taking care of our elderly, and not taking care of our veterans. You know, to date, there have been as many suicides as combat deaths in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Is that right?
Just think about that. It's the notion of war. You know, we look at Vietnam in terms of the combat casualties there. There have been twice as many suicides since then. War is not the answer. And we need to shift that percentage of what's been in military into terms of diplomacy and real nation building and real economics in those countries, and at the same time shift those percentages to take care of our folks right here at home.
Which is completely rational, and probably a great majority of people understand that basic concept, but you're going up against a war machine that has tremendous power in Congress.
And at the same time, a war machine that's... And you compare, you know, Vietnam in terms of what's happening in Iraq, you know, the corporate influence is tremendous. And even, you know, we get down to the reality that that the night before the vote for preemptive attack on Iraq, we polled all the congressional offices in Washington, D.C., and it was 100-1 against war. Yet our congressmen voted another way. And we need to really come back to what influences votes. 100-1. We had Georgetown students poll every office in Congress. It was 100-1 in terms of the phone calls, the emails, the faxes of the American citizenry. But yet it was almost completely voted the other way.
So they're not representing us.
Yeah, and at the same time, you know, as we look at our Congress
even in the Republican districts?
Yes. Yes. And so as we look at our Congress and even the most progressive element, the progressive caucus of the Democratic Party, you know, it's very clear, put directly to their staff, that the influence of lobbyists, corporate special interests, are greater than what the citizens vote. And so, therefore, as I look at the big picture, I have to look at campaign finance reform if we're ever going to change this attitude around war.
So when you are working in the peace movement in the United States, obviously there's this whole movement to get people to do this apparently not very effective action of letting their representatives know what they think. What about actually, how are you doing on campaign finance reform?
Well, you know, that which was put forth by McCain and Feingold a number of years ago, and Senator Russ Feingold, I'm from Wisconsin, happy to be here in Santa Fe, is a friend, but that wasn't true campaign finance reform. And so that element within our citizenry and government really has to change in terms of the influence of I don't want to use the big words of the military-industrial complex or corporate military, but at the same time, Eisenhower spoke and warned of that right after World War II, and it's a big part of how decisions are made in this country. You know, the other part I want to mention, too, is that as we talk about the American citizenry, you know, we have not had war in our backyard. And so when we look at how the rest of the world feels and what we see from the rest of the world, it's because they've suffered it within their families. And here we're in a situation of non-human, non-manned drones killing people in other countries so their body bags aren't coming back. We have a lot to change from that standpoint in terms of what we understand and feel.
I think that President Obama probably understands everything that you have just said, and yet here we are going into Afghanistan with great force. What is going on there, in your view?
Well, you know, it's a political situation. It's one that, you know, and a lot of folks don't want to hear this, but we make money off of war, and also it's about controlling resources.
And you think Obama is just kowtowing to those forces that are making money off of war?
Well, I think it comes back down to being reelected in terms of also who's the influence of lobbyists and special interests and corporations, you know. And so within that context, again, you know, the voice of the American public is not heard as well as those from other areas. And that has to do with the decision-making in Congress.
Well, this conversation and much, much more can be had on Friday night at 7 o'clock at the Unitarian Church, which is on the corner of Galisteo and Barcelona. George Pass Martin will be there, and his talk will be titled Working for Peace, U.S. and International Peace Movements. We look forward to seeing you there on Friday.
Thank you so much.
I'm very happy now to welcome Niels Hansen, James Stewart, Colon Studi, Vince Tompkins, Josh Tompkins, who are all members of the original teen comedy troupe Clown Patrol, and their director, Rima Miller. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So you are doing, the group of you is doing a performance this Saturday, the 12th of December, at Yoga Moves Studio at 825 Early Street. Actually, there's going to be a couple of performances, 5:30 and 6:30, because it's already so popular. Rima, how did this group start?
This group started from a summer program, and we just continued. I teach physical comedy and clowning during the summer. I teach a camp. And many of the children just wanted to continue. And some of these kids have been with me since before they were teenagers.
And so the two of you, for example, were you just got into clowning through going to camp?
Yeah. It was a summer program, like a two-week thing. And it was just so much fun that we kept doing it throughout.
Is it clowning in the sense of putting on clown costumes and things like that?
No, it's more just like physical and improv clowning.
Yeah, just going out there and doing what we do best, just making stuff up and making people laugh.
Yep.
So it's a boys' thing. Is that right, Rima? Or did you have girls in it? Did you have girls in it as well?
Yes, we had girls in it for many years also, and at puberty, some of the girls dropped out, and so I decided that it would be great to have a boys' clown patrol and just have boys and not invite girls anymore. So as they've matured, they've really become the teen boys' clown patrol, and I will not invite girls into this particular troupe anymore because they're so creative on their own.
Very interesting. Well, I was hoping that you guys would put a little bit of your work on the radio right now. Do you have anything prepared from your performance that's going to be happening this Saturday night?
Yep.
Yeah.
Go for it.
Howdy, Mr. W.
Well, hey there, Billy.
Wow, that's a nice colored lawn you have.
Thank you.
Well, here's your mail. You have a nice day now.
You too, Billy.
Howdy, Mr. X. Nice day, isn't it?
Today sucks.
Oh, well, here's your mail.
Yeah, get off my property.
But don't you want your mail?
I don't need your mail. Your mail's junk. Garbage, that's what it is.
Good morning, Mr. Y. Wow, are those clownfish in your pond? Let me see if I have any mail for them today. Nope, no mail for them, but here's your mail, Mr. Y. You'll win that lawn competition for sure.
Meeper.
Good morning, Mr. Z.
Hello, Billy.
Your lawn sure is looking quite, unique today.
Why, thank you. I watered it with the blood of children that lied to their parents. Did you lie to your parents?
Here's your mail. You have a nice day now. You'll win that competition for sure.
Okay, there we have a little taste of the Clown Patrol. It's an original teen comedy troupe that is going to be performing this coming Saturday, the 12th. of December at Yoga Moves, which is at 825 Early Street in Santa Fe. You can call 989-1072 for reservations. I would like to know, what is actually involved in training people to do physical comedy, learning to do physical comedy?
A lot of bruising. A lot of bruising. And plus, it's sort of, you got to make everything more elaborate than it really needs to be, so it's funnier that way.
Exaggeration,
yeah. So, like, just simple tasks like just mowing the lawn are just completely blown out of proportion, or something goes horribly wrong, and you've got to make it, it just goes downhill from there. And you got to just play that all out with your body as well as your voice.
And It's always, I would imagine, for you, Rima Miller, as director, there's always the question is it funny when they do it that way? And you have to stand aside and see whether it's funny, goofy, ridiculous.
Well, the key to comedy is timing. So they can do an action, and they can splat themselves against the wall, and it may not work. But if it's in relationship to something else and the timing works, and that's where I come in to help them work with timing. Fortunately, these guys have had a lot of experience with doing this for many years. So they have more innate comic timing at this point. But no, we definitely work on slapstick. We work on falls.
What is slapstick? Like, how would you describe or define slapstick?
The old version of slapstick is, let's say there's a scene and one person gets angry at the other and he throws a punch to his best buddy, and his best buddy ducks, and he ends up hitting the chair, which knocks on the floor, which rolls to the ground and bumps the table, which comes back up and hits himself on the butt.
It sounds like an old Rube Goldberg cartoon.
Exactly. And so we do these elaborate kinds of crazy physical moments.
And so the timing and the precision of those things, you have to practice, I would think, a whole lot.
Oh, yeah. Or else it's just genuinely not funny. And being in the comedy group that we're in, we kind of want to be funny.
Yes, I would think so.
Our whole purpose.
This is actually their third show. Their third original show. The first show was The Return of the Hillbilly Vampire, which was extremely physical. A lot of running around and chasing and dying. Dramatic deaths are a lot of fun. And their second one was
absolutely ridiculous. It was the, what was it?
The Jamaican Me Crazy.
The Jamaican Me Crazy Park. It was just, it was a lot of movement and a lot of timing, and it took forever just to get right down. But came out all perfectly and a lot of laughs, so that's all that really mattered to us.
Niels Hansen, James Stewart, Colin Studi, Vince Tompkins, Josh Tompkins, director Rima Miller. Anything else before we go, gentlemen?
We'd just like to say we all homies here. And we'd love for you guys to come and see our show. It's a laugh riot, and it'll just be a great time for everybody.
Totally. Yep.
There we have it. We're going to take a break right now. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'm very happy now to welcome Santa Fe's Mayor David Koss this coming Friday. Hi, it's great to see you. It's great to hear you. You're traveling and away by phone, but this coming Friday the 11th of December at 9:30 in the morning for a couple of hours, there will be a forum that you are hosting on jobs and economic growth. What is going on? This is in conjunction with a program that comes from Washington, that comes from President Obama's administration.
I'm sure this is something that mayors across the country are putting together. As everybody knows, we're trying to work our way out of this recession, and the most serious problem in front of us right now is unemployment. Santa Fe County has actually lost about 2,000 jobs. And so we want to look at how we start to get those jobs back. I think it's really important right now to be looking at all the ways that we can put people back to work. And what we'll be talking about in part is, you know, what are the economic pieces of this? What kind of partnerships, such as what we did with the College of Santa Fe, where we saved over 100 jobs and have the potential to create many more. But how many pieces are there in construction and retail, in the creative fields, in arts and culture, to start getting some of these jobs back in place and make them better jobs even than what we have?
How does the kind of job loss that we've had in Santa Fe and Santa Fe County reflect the pattern that's going on in the country?
Well, we've been lucky in a sense in Santa Fe in that our unemployment rate has moved up to over 7%, which is hard for us. But when it's 10% in the rest of the country and some places even higher, we need to count our blessings. But I also think we need to look at our assets and and do everything we can to get people back to work right now.
So what will be happening at the forum? Who is invited? Who should attend?
Well, everyone should attend if they can make it at that time. There'll be a panel at the first part that Zane Fisher will be the moderator. And we have folks like Marie Longsear from the Business Incubator and folks from the Community College, from the banks, Fidel from First Los Alamos National Bank. We'll be talking about the various components, what's strong, what can be strengthened in Santa Fe. And then we'll have a kind of an open floor for people to give us their ideas and suggestions. And we'll be using these ourselves in Santa Fe. And we will also forward this on in a report to the White House.
What is the basis of our economy at this point? What are our greatest strengths?
Well, you know, the basis of the Santa Fe economy is government. It's hospitality. It's art and culture. It's becoming higher education. What's suffering a lot right now is construction and retail, and those are starting to see a comeback. So we want to push on that. So I think we have the strengths we have for the railroad, or the rail yard, the College of Santa Fe, the Community College, and a really great local business community. We're going to run through this.
You know what? You're cutting out a little bit. If we can go back and just, you started saying a moment ago, the strengths we have. Can you just start there and say it again?
Sure.
Because we lost a lot of what you said.
You know, Santa Fe has some really great economic assets. We have great people and a great business community. But we also have a new community convention center that just got LEED Gold certified. We have an airport that's humming right now with our three flights daily leaving, and that's creating jobs. We have the rail yard and the rail runner coming in. We have a revitalized College of Santa Fe. It's actually looking at having 800 students next year. So you put that with the strengths that we have at the community college. And also a very strong local business. So I think we have a lot of great assets, and we need to really focus on strengthening those and developing those to get back some of those jobs that we've lost in the economy.
There's always the question of short-term and long-term economic development. Obviously, if people are out of work, you need to get jobs created as quickly as possible. Then there's also questions about education and development of clean industries in the long run. What are you looking to in the latter department?
Well, in the long run, we're very excited about the green economy, green-collar jobs. We have a great partnership with the community college, and there'll be a speaker about the sustainable technology center that's going up at the community college. But I think in the long run, when you look at those types of jobs in wind and solar and moving into a more energy independent economy for Santa Fe, that has a lot of promise for us. We remain one of the leading cities in the country for art and culture, so jobs in film, jobs in the various art and cultural offerings that we have are going to be strong for us in the future. And those are the kinds of things that we'll be talking about Friday morning.
Well, we look forward to that. Once again, the Mayor's Forum on Jobs and Economic Growth is this Friday, December 11th, from 9:30 to 11 in the morning, 11:30 in the morning at the Santa Fe Community Convention Center. And Mayor Koss, thanks for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you, Mary Charlotte. A pleasure.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org. My email is radiocafe@ksfr.org. The podcast site is santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services. You can hear the show there anytime you want. Stay tuned for the BBC. And after that, Good Morning Jazz features the song of the month, Don't Get Around Much Anymore, and an interview with Joshua Breakstone.